Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. We are supported by listeners. My thanks to Carl Hesterberg, Anuel Rinaldi, Linda Gray, and Deborah Gordon. If you're able and so inclined, you can help too. Just log on to peterbcollins.com. On the right-hand side of the homepage, the information's there, and our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. But the show is free, and we encourage you to share it, spread it around to like-minded individuals. We continue on the Peter B. Collins Show. It's sponsored by Cinema Classics, the movie company specializing in classic Hollywood and foreign films. Check out their 30% off sale and their great collection of old movies on DVD and VHS. Just click on the link at my homepage, peterbcollins.com. And you can get free shipping on any order. Just enter PBC in the comments section of the website order form. In a moment, we go to Gaza City for a first-person account of the situation on the ground there. We're going to talk to an activist and peacemaker, Ken O'Keefe. And I wanted to open it up with an American activist and peacemaker, Michael Franti.
I don't need a passport to walk on this earth. Anywhere I go, because I was made of this earth. I'm born of this earth. I breathe of this earth, and even with the pain, I believe in this earth. So I wake up every morning, and I'm stepping on the floor. I wake up every morning, and I'm stepping out the door. I got faith in the sky, faith in the one, faith in the people rocking underneath the sun. Because every bit of land is a holy land, and every drop of water is a holy water. And every single child is a son or a daughter of the one earth mama and the one earth papa. So don't tell a man that he can't come here, because he got brown eyes and a wavy kind of hair. And don't tell a woman that she can't go there, because she prays a little different to a God up there. You say you're a Christian because God made you. You say you're a Muslim because God made you. You say you're a Hindu and the next man a Jew. Then we all kill each other because God told us to. No, hello, hello, hello.
Just a few years back, Michael Franti took a guitar and a video camera, toured the Middle East, including hotspots in Gaza and the West Bank, and captured it in a powerful documentary film. Kenneth O'Keefe is an Irish-American activist, a former U.S. Marine, and he checks in today from Gaza City in the occupied territory of Palestine. Welcome to our program, Ken. It's great to talk with you.
Well, thank you for having me, brother.
Tell us a little bit about your background and why you care about the plight of the Palestinian people.
Well, like most every American, I grew up believing my country was the greatest in the world. Eventually, I joined the Marine Corps at the age of 19. I had an experience in the Marine Corps in which I ended up speaking out against some abuse of power, and I went from being a model Marine to being, the biggest piece of shit, the 17 years in the Marine Corps that my platoon sergeant had ever experienced, and he made my life very, very difficult, and... I realized that I was really very wrong about the Marine Corps, at least my experience of it, and it made me think, what else am I wrong about? And I got out of the Marine Corps, and I commenced to a course of independent study. I read stuff from Noam Chomsky. I read Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. I read the autobiography of Malcolm X, and a lot of other sources of information that you wouldn't typically read. And I realized, basically, I'd been lied to my whole life. I realized that I had volunteered to give up my freedom to be a Marine, and ultimately put myself in a position to kill or be killed. And, well, it made me angry, and it motivated me to learn more. And, you know, the more I learned, the more I realized that the world, in fact, was full of illusions. And, well, I could either take the blue pill, as it were, in the Matrix and continue to be in a slumber, or take the red pill and wake up and see the world for what it is, no matter how daunting it may be. And I chose the red pill and have never looked back.
You founded an organization called Aloha Palestine. Explain the name and your mission, please.
Well, I lived in Hawaii for many years, and in fact, I'm a Hawaiian national as well. You can add Hawaiian
okay.
to Irish, and I was a former American. I renounced my U.S. citizenship back in March of 2001. I actually have honorary Palestinian citizenship, but anyway, going back to Hawaii, one of the mistakes people make is thinking of things in terms of race. You know, Hawaii was a nation, a sovereign nation. It was stolen by America in 1893. According to international law, there's no statute of limitations on such crime, and America has admitted to actually stealing that nation, public law 103-150, which was signed into law by President Bill Clinton in 1993. Anyway, bottom line is that I was involved in the Hawaiian independence movement, and while I was involved in that movement, I ultimately became involved in human rights, and human rights really ultimately was what kind of got me into ill favor with the United States government, and I left the United States 2 months after 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually all of this human rights movement moved me towards Palestine, and I got involved in the Palestinian issue because, well, I visited Palestine back in 2003, 2004, and developed a relationship with the people, and I realized that the people of Palestine are exactly the same as the people of Hawaii in one incredible way. You know, if you've ever been to Hawaii, you hear this word aloha all the time, and it's
sure.
been very prostituted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really has. But there is this something really beautiful known as aloha, and it's more than hello and goodbye. It's a way of living. It's the way that the Hawaiian people are, despite over 117 years of occupation and many, many crimes that most Americans will never know of. These people are amongst the most generous and hospitable people you will ever meet. They may not have much, but when you're in their land, they will give you everything they have.
Mm-hmm.
And all they ask is to be paid some respect. The Palestinians are exactly the same way. I'm sitting here in Gaza today. I can walk to any part of Gaza on my own, and I will never have a problem. Never have a problem, unless, of course, the Israelis are bombing again.
Mm-hmm. And they have been. We'll talk about that in a moment.
And they have, yes.
Yes.
They are indeed. And the bottom line is that this name, Aloha Palestine, stems from this amazing similarity. Although the struggles are different, they're both occupied lands. Hawaii is an occupied land, as is Palestine. And, of course, the violence levels is very different. But the nature of the people is remarkably similar. The Palestinian people, you know, contrary to what so many Americans have been conned into believing, are incredibly nonviolent. And that may sound outrageous for a lot of people to even hear it, but that's the truth. If you were to put Americans in the same situation as the Palestinians, if you were to subject the American people to the kind of occupation that the Palestinians have endured, with the kinds of human rights violations and crimes against humanity, such as using white phosphorus on the people. I met a young girl today with white phosphorus burns. She lost six of her siblings in Operation Cast Lead. One of them was turned into a piece of black, charred flesh. The father was killed. Other sisters were killed. Can you imagine what an American family, an American father or mother, uncle or aunt, imagine how they would react
mm-hmm.
to their family being bombed like that? Now, that's the kind of thing that's been happening here for decades, literally. White phosphorus may be somewhat new, but similar types of crimes have been committed against the Palestinian people for decades. The vast majority of Palestinians are not violent. There are violent people within the Palestinian resistance, of course there are, but if the same crime had happened to the Americans, my God, would there be blood in the streets? And I don't think the American people would be half as capable as the patience or forgiveness that the Palestinian people have endured. It is one of the great crimes that the victim here in Palestine, the Palestinian people, have been cast as this inherently violent criminal. They are incredibly patient and amazingly dignified despite the horrendous circumstances they have endured. And again, in this respect, I see so much similarity to the Hawaiian people, who also carry themselves with tremendous dignity despite horrendous injustice for them as well.
Now, Ken, we'll return to the subject of the blockade of Gaza and efforts by activists like you to break it. You were on the Mavi Marmara earlier this year, where eight or nine individuals were killed by Israeli forces on Memorial Day, American reference. And I do want to return to that. But first, if you could, since you are right there in Gaza, we've been getting fragmentary reports of recent Israeli airstrikes, January 2nd, January 3rd, and even perhaps on January 4th. The reports and the dates sometimes don't quite line up. But there have been Israeli airstrikes on Gaza, and I wonder if you could just give us a scene setter of conditions there right now and the extent to which people fear a more massive Israeli military action either currently or in the near future.
Well, you know, they're used to threats here. It's pretty constant, so it can be somewhat hard to identify what is just the norm and what is actually more substantial. And even with that, it appears very, very distinctly possible that there is going to be a second Operation Cast Lead. Actually, almost immediately upon arriving here, almost at exactly the same time, which was late November, the violence has been stepping up. I think about 30 people have been shot since I arrived in late November in the so-called buffer zone, which is a 300-yard area from the wall inwards into cropland mostly. And about 30 people have been shot there who were collecting rocks outside of the buffer zone. Sorry, not within the 300. You definitely get shot if you get within 300 meters, but outside. Mm-hmm. About 30 people, including children. I met one of them, 15-year-old kid, collecting rocks. They do that because there's no jobs here, and there's no cement, no building materials, no steel, things like that are not allowed in. So they collect the rocks, and then they crush them into dust, and they make that into cement. So the kids go out and collect this stuff as a means to help provide for the family, and they do this every day. And the kid that I met was doing this every day, and they were shooting. They shot him twice in the leg. Now, they know who they're shooting at, and they certainly know that these kids are not a threat. For the Israelis, this is literally a game, and there is no repercussions. They're clearly giving the sanction to do this. None of them are getting any kind of punishment. It's just part of the game that's being played.
And I can inject just a little sarcasm here, Israelis would define rocks as dual-use items, right? Because you describe the intent of the Palestinians in collecting them. But like so many things on an arbitrary basis, Israel defines things that they think could be used in any way as a weapon or some artifact or implement that could even remotely be used to create a weapon or a rocket. They declare those dual use and prevent them from being brought into Gaza. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't actually heard them use the excuse that they were collecting weapons, but it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, there really is an alternate universe there in Israel. As duped and ignorant as the American people are, they're topped by the Israelis, I can assure you of that. It really is a testament to the power of propaganda that an entire population can be as stupid as the Israeli people are, and not only stupid, but extremely violent or supportive of extreme violence. And it's really quite tragic. It is to no one's benefit. And the Israelis, you know, like the Americans, quite frankly, we can find a lot of parallels here. You know, Americans are like this spoiled brat child that had everything going for it, and it's just throwing it all away. I mean, these people who call themselves patriots are sitting over the governments that have been trashing the U.S. Constitution to the point that it hardly exists anymore, giving $1 trillion away to the bankers while you're losing your jobs and losing your benefits. I mean, it's so ridiculously obvious how the people have been duped and so indoctrinated that they can't even think anymore. It wouldn't surprise me if the Israeli propaganda machine said that this 15-year-old kid was collecting rocks as weapons and therefore he had to be shot. But the truth is, as I said, they're collecting them so they can be crushed into dust so that they can make cement. Mm-hmm. But 2 years on, you ask, you know, what are the conditions? 2 years on, you know, there were thousands and thousands of homes. About 80,000 homes were partially damaged. I forget the exact number, but it's several thousand homes were completely destroyed.
Bulldozed, yes.
With no cement and building materials allowed in. You can imagine there's a bit of a housing problem here.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they do whatever they can, not only to build homes, but to also get some money. I think, you know, one of the next questions, and maybe I'll just preempt you here, is, you know, a lot of Americans apparently think that there's you know, plenty of goods getting in and Israel is allowing it all and this, that, and the other. If you had, even if that were the case, and it's not, there is certainly enough food here if you can afford it. But how do you get food? You know, is there free stores for food in America? I think, from what I understand, people still have to buy it over there, and the same thing is true here.
Mm-hmm.
So you may have a store, but unless you have money to buy food, where are you going to get it? And the way it works here is if you're not in a refugee camp, if you're not a refugee, and about half the population is in that category, then you're not going to be getting food from the UN or the main charity organizations for the most part. So you're going to need to buy your food.
Mm-hmm.
And even the refugees aren't able to get all the food that they need. And that's been well documented. The UN has said on more than one occasion that they're not able to get all the supplies they need to keep up with the demand. Even if things have been eased, as the euphemism, the word is,
mm-hmm.
It's still not changing the fact that people can't afford the food. And the children are malnourished, they're anemic, they have all sorts of vitamin deficiencies and developmental problems. So the conditions are extremely harsh.
And Ken, just a specific question, because I was informed a couple of years ago that the Israeli blockade, in its very specific terms, just one example, defined pasta as a luxury food, and therefore said this is not a staple and we won't allow pasta into the Gaza Strip. Is pasta now permitted?
It is, yes. I've seen pasta here. I've even had some since I've been here. But, you know, don't use logic. If you want to try and understand the system that is in place to define what can get in and what can't get in, if you use logic, you're going to make a huge mistake. There's no logic to it. However, there is a very well-documented explanation for what exactly the real intent of all this is. And it's been said that the Israeli leadership wanted to put the Palestinians on a diet. They use that word, diet, and effectively make life extremely difficult. And that's what they've done. You know, they let just enough in to be able to make sure that people aren't starving. That would be a PR problem. And I'm sure if it wasn't a matter of PR issues that they would do that, but it would be a problem.
Well, then Ken,
malnourished.
Let me put this in a slightly different frame, because on January 5th, one of the WikiLeaks diplomatic cables from the United States State Department that was reported on by the Norwegian newspaper Aftenpost describes Israel as deliberately maintaining the economy of the Gaza Strip, quote, on the brink of collapse, without, quote, pushing it over the edge. And the quotation goes on, as part of their overall embargo plan against Gaza, Israeli officials have confirmed on multiple occasions that they intend to keep the Gazan economy on the brink of collapse without quite pushing it over the edge. And that's quite consistent with what you just said.
Yeah, no, it is. And the only thing that I would want to make clear there is that predates anything that WikiLeaks has put out. That information was known previous to that, and it's very much not hidden for those of us who are paying any real attention. But of course, it's not understood in the American public, nor is it largely understood in the European public or others for that matter, because, well, we We don't have legitimate media, do we? We have prostitutes, as far as I'm concerned, who pose as journalists. They've sold their soul for a propaganda machine that makes people more and more ignorant, and that's the problem, really, I think, more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Now, what is the status of the water supply? Because there's been grave concern over several years now about the bombing of a water purification plant and the inability of the Palestinians to rebuild it.
Yeah, I mean, the infrastructure has been absolutely devastated. The electricity is out for normally 8 hours a day in most areas, and some areas even more so. When you don't have electricity, pumping water is impossible. So, you know, getting water is also an issue. Yes, there is no, the tap water is not drinkable. You can't drink it. You have to get special water, which is usually in collection points, distribution points in the communities. So you have to go get it. You know, there are a lot of children who are actually drinking water that is not suitable because of the difficulty of getting it. And it's, you know, a human right. That's one of the many human rights that's being violated here. And it's one of those things that it's quite manageable from a public relations standpoint. You know, it's different from cast lead, where you kill hundreds of people, over 1,000, 1,400 people.
Mm-hmm.
That's harder to hide. But when children are just going without clean water and, you know, having health problems and so on and so forth, it doesn't register as much.
And Ken, the Operation Cast Lead that you're referring to, I just want to refresh listeners' recollection, because it occurred 2 years ago, and at this point in early January, the Israelis were starting to mop up. But while Americans were celebrating the change of the guard, and we had optimism about the Obama administration, at least many people did, Israel took advantage of that period of time when there was a vacuum in leadership, and Obama really didn't break silence and talk about what Israel had done. But you correctly pointed out that over 1,300 Palestinians were killed. 13 Israelis, 8 of whom were uniformed soldiers, died during that period of time. And the disproportionality of that is stunning. It led to a UN High Commission where the facts were laid out. And even though that commission went to great lengths to try to appear to be even-handed, that report, which labeled many of Israel's actions as contemptible and rising to the level of war crimes, was repudiated not only by the Israelis, but by the United States Congress, led by a Democratic majority and with the support of then our new president. And I find that horrifying, that we, you know, would not allow the Goldstone Commission report to stand on its own, and that we went to great lengths to undermine it and repudiate it. And this tarnishes the hands of all involved and leaves a criminal act by the State of Israel as something that is somehow debatable. And that, you know, Israel insisted on having its own commission report, which, of course, blames everything on the Palestinians. So with that, 2 years ago, what has been rebuilt were the clinics that were targeted, the UN compound that was targeted. Have those facilities been rebuilt to any extent?
Some cement is able to get in. The UN does get some of it, but not even as much as it wants. But virtually everything else is impossible to rebuild, except for what little can come in through the tunnels. Just going back to the crime that was Operation Cast Lead, one of the things that's really, really important for people to realize if they want to actually start to understand what's happening in this world is that this was a very unique attack, invasion, Operation Cast Lead, in that the entire population of Gaza was at that point already 2 years into a blockade, which is, in effect, the creation of a concentration camp. Now, I'm going to use concentration camp not to be overly dramatic, but to be more accurate. A prison denotes criminal behavior. A prison houses people who've broken laws. A prison provides generally three meals a day and medical services. This is not a prison. The people here are not getting three square meals a day. The people here are not criminals. They're Palestinian. And in that sense, they're exactly the same as the Jews and the Gypsies and the others who Hitler rounded up and put into the concentration camp. So concentration camp is actually a much more accurate description of what Gaza is today. Now, to have that camp then attacked meant that those in the area, in the camp, were not able to run, to flee. So what we had was sort of a medieval type of situation in which people were locked into a very small area, one of the most densely populated areas in the world, and then attacked by the fourth largest military in the world. Now, today, I've been meeting a lot of families recently, but today I've visited a family in an area called Tabata. And this family had six members, all brothers and sisters, and the mother and an aunt were killed, all by white phosphorus. Two of them died about 6 months later. The mother died about 6 months later. One of the girls, a little four-year-old girl, was burnt to a crisp and looked like a blackened piece of charcoal. And the others were likewise completely destroyed. Now, white phosphorus landing on a home in a suburb-type environment, that's the kind of thing that was happening. And it's not my opinion. It's not this family's opinion. It's on video. We can go on YouTube and watch it. This is the kind of thing that was happening to a captive audience. And the American people can feel good tonight knowing that you paid for that and that you may pay for it again. That's the reality. And I don't care what you have to say about the adult population here. There's 800,000 plus children in Gaza. Those 800,000 plus children have been traumatized. I can tell you, today and in previous days, I've met children who haven't talked for the last 2 years, ever since they saw things that no child should ever see in their life. I've got a two-year-old, and I was speaking to him today on Skype, and he loves his father, absolutely loves his father. He's bright. He just, you know, he's bubbly. Everybody loves him. But I tell you what, if you took my child and you had him walk through the blood and the guts and the body parts, as I've seen with three children today as well, who did the same thing, did that very same thing at a police station after it was hit, what would happen to him? Well, we all know what would happen to any child you put him through that. That's the kind of thing that has happened here. And all of these children, to one degree or another, have been traumatized. And some of them are so traumatized that they don't speak, they can't sleep properly, they're not concentrating or capable of going to school anymore. They have no hope for the future at all, and they're terrified every time they hear a jet fly over, which I can tell you happens every single day. That is a situation that we as Americans have created, and until we wake the hell up and start to pay attention to what it is that we're paying for with our taxes, it shall continue. And it is tragic beyond belief that we would be so stupid as to continue that sort of thing. I wish it was possible to bring every single American here somehow, some way, and get them to meet these children. They're beautiful children. They really are. They're beautiful children, just like all children. They just want to be loved. They just want security. And the situation that they're enduring is ungodly.
We're talking with Ken O'Keefe. He is in Gaza City as we speak. And Ken, Juan Cole, the professor from the University of Michigan, who has a powerful blog at juancole.com, he too picked up on a WikiLeaks disclosed cable. And I want to read you a little bit here from Cole's article. And again, this was released by the Norwegian paper Aftenpost. And this paper has summarized an Israeli military briefing by Israeli Chief of Staff General Gabi Ashkenazi of a U.S. congressional delegation a little over a year ago. The memo on the talks between Ashkenazi and Ike Skelton, who was defeated in November and was chairing the Armed Services Committee in the House, as well as numerous other documents from the same period of time, leave a clear message. The Israeli military is forging ahead at full speed with preparations for a new war in the Middle East. The general's plans are driven by fear of growing stockpiles of rockets in Hamas-controlled Gaza and Hezbollah-controlled southern Lebanon, the likely theaters of the planned major new war. Ashkenazi does not seem capable of considering that given a number of Israeli invasions and occupations of those regions, the rockets may be primarily defensive. Ashkenazi told the visiting delegation that Israeli unmanned drones had had great success in identifying rocket emplacements in southern Lebanon, and that it had been aided in this endeavor by the U.S. National Security Agency, which spies on communications. The new major war will be a total war on civilians, Ashkenazi boasted. In the next war, Israel cannot accept any restrictions on warfare in urban areas. Now, this is remarkable, and it's something that Americans deserve to know. This is one of those cables that Joe Biden describes the disclosure of as treasonous and calls Julian Assange a terrorist. I believe that Americans have a right to know this information because of our incredible support for Israel on a financial, on a diplomatic and political, and most importantly, on a military level. And to read this is so chilling, but I want to hear your thoughts about this from the ground in Gaza.
It's a reflection of just how sociopathic and psychopathic the leadership within the Israeli structure is. It's not exaggerations to say that these people are absolutely mad. To talk like that, to suggest that you would not be held by any restraint, which obviously means international law doesn't apply, to suggest that you would use all the weapons in your arsenal even worse than you did the first time around is unimaginable if you have any sanity at all. But that's exactly what's being said by the leader of the Israeli military. So, and now let's just imagine that you've been dealing with that same type of thing for 60-plus years. Think how you would feel, because that is. In fact, it's even been worse. I mean, you know, for decades, no one was paying any attention at all. Nobody. And this is the kind of attitude that was coming from the Israeli side. Now, talk about turning things on their head. Black is white, white is black. I mean, living in George Orwell's 1984, the terrorist is the liberator and the liberator is the terrorist. The state of Israel has, from its very beginning, acted in a way that would be completely in line with the principles of the fiction that is Al-Qaeda, the idea that using violence as a means of affecting political conduct or political goals is perfectly acceptable. That is what Israel has been doing from day one, and they're still doing it. Here we are in 2010, 2008, they proved it. I mean, again, let us watch the videos. You cannot tell me that firing white phosphorus, as it was done in one of the most densely populated areas in the world, is anything but a war crime. I would love to hear any of the so-called politicians, leaders, prostitutes again, every single last one of them, with rare exception, are prostitutes, that government, Democrat, Republican, what a scam, what a sham. How long will it take for Americans to realize you have been hoodwinked? Doesn't matter. Two sides of the same coin. I would love to hear any one of them explain to me how it could be justifiable to fire white phosphorus into such areas, like the family that I met today. And yet, none of them will deal with that. And I'd also like to hear why Barack Obama wouldn't answer a straight question when he was asked, is he aware of any nation in the Middle East who has nuclear weapons? Why is he not answering the question? Why is this man pretending as if he has any honor? If you had any honor at all, you would answer that question, because we all know, all of us who have a brain and still use it, know who has nuclear weapons in the Middle East and who is the biggest threat in the Middle East. And yet we won't find a president who will utter a word of truth regarding these things. This is the world that we live in, and the people who call themselves patriots are nothing more than idiots and dupes if they're supporting this system. Let me just say, as I say that, I've been an idiot and a dupe, and I volunteered to be a killer or to be killed. So I'm not looking down on everyone. I actually have great love for the American people. I feel sorry for them, that they have
allowed themselves to be so hoodwinked. And I'm hoping that by the financial crisis, with things getting harder and harder, especially with something so blatant, so in your face, as your government giving away $1 trillion to the bankers who have just posted record profits yet again and are giving as big a bonuses, if not even bigger bonuses, here in 2010, 2011, the bankers are getting even bigger bonuses than they did before you, the American taxpayer, just gave them $1 trillion. How frickin' stupid do you need to be before we can finally realize we are being used? I'm hoping we've reached the lowest of the low, the depths of the low with stupidity. And now we start thinking a little bit more because times are getting tough. Because it's not just a matter of times getting tough and losing your job. We are flirting with a third world war, literally.
Well, Ken, I appreciate the statement there. I would only offer one friendly amendment. You understate the amount of money we shelled out to the bankers. The total amount of cash and assumed liabilities is somewhere north of $13 trillion. And that is not acknowledged by our government, but it has been reliably reported by sources who I have interviewed. Ken, next I want to turn to the efforts of people of many nations to break the Israeli blockade of Gaza. I have supported and reported on the various Gaza Freedom Flotillas that have attempted to break the blockade. And some of the Americans who've been on board. And just as a matter of note, today I'm wearing a T-shirt that I got from Colonel Ann Wright as she is raising funds for an American ship to be called the Audacity of Hope, stolen from the president's best-selling book title. And this is a hoped-for effort because I know they're pretty close to meeting their fundraising goals that should occur over the next 4 or 5 months. And I support that effort, and I also support the efforts that you have been involved in. Let's talk first about the Mavi. Well, actually, I want to interrupt myself to ask you first to update us on the Salam, which is an aid ship that has attempted to break the blockade. And this is from a group of Asian activists and charities. Did the Salam make it to port in Gaza City?
Yes, that was the ship transporting goods for the Asian convoy, and the convoy did make it in. They had the same sort of obstacles that we experienced. I was involved in the Road to Hope convoy, and we had a two-month journey with all sorts of challenges, and I'll spare you the details, but one of the big challenges was the Egyptian government, which we know is taking bribe money from the United States to the tune of $1 billion plus, and is basically following the orders of the American government. So they had problems as well, but they did make it in. 50 of the convoy members were barred from getting in, and for no good reason. They can just say you're not allowed in, and that's it. So little by little, the numbers of people who are really dedicated to trying to relieve the pressure and help the Palestinian people are prevented from actually accessing Gaza, as if they were asking to visit Egypt. They're asking to go to Palestine, and so the convoy did make it, the ship did make it, but it's extremely difficult and very costly delivering any kind of aid or support to Palestinians.
Mm-hmm. So back on what Americans call Memorial Day, the end of May of 2010, there was this flotilla that included a large Turkish ship, the Mavi Marmara, and I believe as many as 8 or 9 smaller watercraft that formed a flotilla. And many people are aware of this, but the coverage in the United States was brief and scant and was primarily the highly edited videotapes that the Israeli Defense Ministry provided in advance of the effort of you and others who were on those ships to tell their stories and get their own videos out. And these highly edited tapes were used to spin this event where Israel attacked these unarmed ships and craft on in international waters and had commandos board the Mavi Marmara and ultimately the other craft. and they had the chutzpah to claim that the soldiers were victims, as they you know, were essentially pirates boarding ships. And when you and others resisted or attempted to take into custody these interlopers, these pirates, they again spun that as a violation of the rights of these Israeli soldiers. So with that spin, I'd like to ask you to take a couple of minutes here to describe the events of the Israeli raid on the Mavi Marmara as you saw them, and your own role in disarming an Israeli soldier, removing his weapon, emptying the bullets, and the way that was later described by the Israelis when they demonized you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, first off, let's just recap here. The Israelis and the Turkish were allies and had very strong relations at the time, and the Turkish government had inspected that vessel and verified that there were no weapons, and there were no weapons, for Christ's sake. You can't count kitchen knives as weapons. the ship had no weapons. The blockade is totally illegal. Not even the United States at this point would say that it's legal. And certainly every legitimate international law expert is going to say that it's illegal. It's a form of collective punishment. There are 800,000 plus children in Gaza that are now going into their fourth year of this cruel and inhuman blockade. So we were delivering aid that was of benefit to these children and to an innocent population. And as you mentioned, we were attacked in international waters. Now, I was there. I can tell you that we were being shot at from the first moment of contact. In fact, I came across the first dead body within the first 5 minutes of the attack, and that was a gentleman who was never at the top deck of the ship. He was carrying a camera because he's a cameraman, and he was actually taking a picture when he got shot right between the eyes, and that was it for him. That was within the first 5 minutes. Within the next few minutes, I saw the second dead body. And having been in a combat situation before, understanding what combat situations are like, I can tell you it was effectively a combat situation in which we did not have combat weapons. And even if we were guilty of defending ourselves, I think people are only exposing just how indoctrinated they are if they're not capable of putting yourself in our position. We weren't actually doing anything wrong. We were bringing aid to a desperately needy population of people. We were in international waters, and armed thugs came onto the ship. Now, we could have sat down and sung Kumbaya, and I think there are plenty of people out there who think that's exactly what we should have done. But I'm just wondering how many American people, if their children were under threat and they were in a position to sit down and sing Kumbaya and watch their children get killed or violated, would they do that or would they fight back? Because if you don't see the Palestinian children as worthy, fine. I get your perspective. You don't give a shit. I mean, I understand how indoctrination works, and, you know, you always turn the other into somebody less, and, you know, the Palestinian children are the other, so they don't really count in the eyes of a lot of people, unfortunately, the American people among them. But they do to us, you know, and I'm a father. I'm a father, and I've been visiting children here today and many days while I've been here, and they're children, for Christ's sake. You know, they're not guilty of anything, and there's 800,000 plus of them. I mean, if you're involved in using sticks or your body to defend a mission that's intended to benefit children, are you wrong? I mean, is that wrong? Is that the world we live in?
But Ken, according to the Israelis, you're not just a child lover. You are a radical anti-Israel activist, an operative of the Hamas terror organization, and you were attempting to enter the Gaza Strip in order to form and train a commando unit for Palestinian terror organizations.
You know, what's really funny about that is that I was in the jail when they kidnapped us, you know, beat some of us and, you know, violated us in virtually every way you can think of, although not nearly as bad as they do Palestinians. I was one of two people another crazy Irishman, I claim my Irish nationality now, who refused to go. We refused to sign any documents. We refused to voluntarily be deported. And I was literally in the jail with my friend Fiacra, an Irish national, and everybody else left because we refused to go. While I was in the jail, and I had plenty of witnesses who were there, I got into a conversation with one of their Mossad or Shin Bet spooks, we got into a conversation, myself and two of them, in front of about 20 or 30 other people, and I said to him, to his face, that I was involved in disarming two of the commandos, and we had three of your commandos, three of them, totally disarmed, completely at our mercy. We could have done anything to them, and you know, what did we do? We let them go. We didn't need to let them go, believe you me. Having taken a 9mm pistol off of one of them, if I wanted to, all I needed to do was take that thing off of safety, and I would have ended that commando's life right then and there. So, if I'm a terrorist, I'm a pretty fucking useless one now, aren't I? I mean, Jesus Christ, if I got a 9mm pistol off of my sworn enemy, I don't know, you kind of think that I would have used the weapon and taken him out, but I didn't do that because I'm not a killer, and I'm certainly not a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
I am, however, a man who refuses to bow down to tyranny, and if need be, I'm prepared to die for such a thing, but I'm not prepared to kill, unless, of course, I absolutely had to, if it was the only way to save my life or the life of my family, then, of course, I would do that. And I ask every American again, would you do that? I mean, if you had to. And isn't that what the Palestinians are doing? Isn't that what the Iraqis are doing? Isn't that what the Afghanis are doing? They're only doing what you would do if you were in their situation. And if you were in their situation and you didn't fight back, you would be a coward, quite frankly. You certainly would not be a terrorist. You would be a coward. And we weren't cowards. The Turkish people are not cowardly people. And I think while we're on this subject, let us not forget that one of those people that was killed was an American citizen.
That's right.
American so-called media likes to pretend as if he wasn't. He was born in America, but because he had darker skin and Turkish citizenship as well, they're happy to parse him off as a Turkish citizen. And so we have an American president who did not a damn thing when an American citizen was actually executed, according to the UN fact-finding mission, which I testified to as well. They concluded that there is strong evidence to show that this young American, 19 years old, was actually on his back, had already been shot once, and was then at point-blank range, shot three more times in the head and once more in the leg. So this kid was executed. Anyway, going back, I've got a bit off track there. I refused to leave. I did everything I could to stay in Israeli custody, refused to sign their documents, was actually beaten twice while I was there, and refused to go, and was the last one to leave. And then after I left, and actually before I left, they had beaten me, and I had blood all over my face, and I refused to wash it off because it was all I had. They stole my laptop. They stole two of my cameras, video camera, still camera, expensive lenses. They stole some other items. They stole everybody's stuff. Amongst all the other things, they're freaking thieves as well, common thieves. So they had stolen everything, and I thought to myself, you know what? All I have is my bloody clothes and my bloody face, so I'm keeping it. And they said to me before I was, you know, they were going to force me to go, they said to me, unless you wash your face, you're not going. I said, fine, I'm not going. I literally had the Irish ambassador call me on the phone and talk to me and beg me to wash my face, and I refused. I said, no, I'm staying here. So this is the circumstance to which I eventually left with my bloody face intact. And when I arrived in Turkey 2 days later, a press release was issued by the Israeli Defense Forces saying that I'm a terrorist, and apparently I was traveling to Gaza to train a commando unit for Hamas. So I actually take that as a great compliment, because the Israeli state is so morally defunct and bankrupt that virtually everything it says has to be considered a bald-faced lie, unless it can provide some evidence, of course, which I'm happy for them to supply some evidence that I'm actually training commando units. I'm here now. I suppose they should send a missile my way. They know where I am anyway. So if a missile does come here, well, you'll know it's because Israel decided to kill me, as they kill other people, out of this accusation of terrorism. I do know for a fact, by the way, that at least two or three journalists have made formal requests for any evidence to support the idea that I'm a terrorist. Of course, there is none. And the Israelis hide behind the whole security thing, as does the American government. So it is really George Orwell's 1984. It really is. I mean, I'll tell you what. I'll be honest with you. I really, really 100% support the right of self-defense. Absolutely. Absolutely. If America was being invaded, and if I was still in America and it was being invaded, what would I do? I would kill. I would kill the invader. I would absolutely do that. There's no question about it. I would not sit by and watch my land be invaded and my family being killed and not kill. I would kill. I would not sit back and watch that happen. And I think most Americans, if they're to be honest with themselves, should respect me for that. Because you wouldn't want the guy next to you who's not willing to fight. The bottom line is, I believe in the right of self-defense 100%. If the American nation was being invaded and people, family members were being killed, your land was being stolen, what would you do? I mean, come on. It's just so ridiculous that we've lost the capacity to even put ourselves in such a simple way in the position of the other. Yeah. You know, if your land is being invaded and occupied, you kill the invader. It's just that simple. I mean, you know, I don't know how many Americans are going to pretend as if, well, no, sorry, if America was being invaded, then, well, no, we shouldn't pick up weapons or anything. You know, no, that's not right. You should only, negotiate and be nonviolent. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. But that's being stripped of your ability to think. I 100% support the right of self-defense. However, I also recognize that the Revolutionary War that won independence for America, if you ask the British, the founding fathers were the terrorists of their day. I also know that Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress were the terrorists of their day, and even Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher called Nelson Mandela a terrorist. I also know that the IRA were the terrorists of their day. Many of them are in the government now. So I also know that those that resist in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine are considered the terrorists of their day. But this is just the same pattern over and over. And only a person who's been stripped of the ability to think can be so stupid as to not see the obvious. I don't support terrorism, as it were. I don't support the idea of randomly killing people. I don't think that it's a wise tactic. I think it's morally corruptive and tragic, and everything about it plays into the hands of the real terrorists, which are the people running our world right now. And the United States being the number one terrorist, it's terrorizing more people than anyone, hands down. I don't believe in being stupid. If you're going to resist, resist for the sake of justice and be intelligent about it. If you're going to resist, fight the enemy that's killing you directly. Like, for instance, the exchange that happened today. I was reading in the Jerusalem Post, they called the Hamas people that got into this exchange of fire with the Israelis, they called them terrorists. Are you joking? Are you joking to call armed Palestinians who are in their land who kill or shoot at Israelis who are killing their people every day to call them a terrorist? You have to be thoroughly indoctrinated to even listen to that type of language. You can call them a terrorist if you like, if they come into Jerusalem and then blow up a nightclub. Fine. You call them a terrorist then. But you don't call them a terrorist when they're in their land and they shoot at soldiers who are killing their people every day. So I'm no terrorist. You know, mm-hmm. I recognize terrorism for what it is. And again, the number one terrorist on the planet is the United States. And the people who are funding that are the American people. And that's going to be a harsh reality that's going to finally, at some point, it's going to have to be acknowledged. The American people are, in essence, the biggest terrorists on the planet by virtue of funding the biggest terrorist acts of our time. That's the truth. It's undeniable. And it's tragic. And America can do much better, and it should.
Ken, I want to ask in closing here what you see as George Mitchell's success or failure to date. And, you know, many people were encouraged that Obama didn't wait until later in his term to attempt to launch some sort of an effort, an initiative to bring the parties together. And it really seems to have spun out into political theater, and the subcategory would be farce.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, it's just only possible to buy into these illusions if you've been stripped of the capacity to think. Barack Obama is like every other president that has followed, that has preceded him. He is a puppet. He is a liar. I mean, he said, what? I'm sorry. Change you can believe in. I'm going to close down Guantanamo Bay. The war in Iraq is the wrong war. We shouldn't be fighting that war. I'm going to get out of Iraq, and we're going to concentrate on this legitimate war in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, that right there, if you have the ability to think, then you're expecting me to believe that Barack Obama is an idiot. This idea that you could defeat terrorism by invading people's lands and then bombing them and killing civilians en masse, that somehow would eliminate terrorism, shows how completely ignorant and stupid and brainwashed somebody has to be. Barack Obama is not an idiot, but he's pretending or acting like he is one. And that, to me, is so obvious and so in our face. He hasn't done any of the important things he said he would do, and we should have never expected it. It's a sad truth that the only legitimate president that America has had in the last, really, quite frankly, 60 years has been John F. Kennedy. And the only reason why he was killed was because he threatened the most powerful individuals. And if you really want to get to where the power is, I'm waiting for the phone to get cut off now, it's the bankers, the ones who, as you say, got $13 trillion. It's the bankers. If you can print the money, then money's paper to you. So anyone who can be bought, you can buy, because you have all the money in the world. And that's how the world functions. So the governments are run by people who can be corrupted. They're not run by people who can't be corrupted, because the media and their fellow politicians and the businessmen and the business people and all this kind of stuff are not going to support a candidate who's not supported by the people who have the money, which is the bankers. This is the system, and it rewards people who are corrupt. And Barack Obama is just another corrupt politician who says what he's supposed to say, but when he gets into office, does the same thing. Now, I really, you know, without getting deeper and deeper, because I know we're at the end of this now, I disagree with Noam Chomsky on one subject, and boy, we got to leave it at this. 9/11 is a false flag operation. The U.S. government was involved at top levels. Israeli Mossad was also involved. And it was a manipulation to get the American people to be so stupid as to go to Iraq and Afghanistan. That's all it was, plain and simple. I love Noam Chomsky, but he's dead wrong on 9/11. But he did say something that was very intelligent, many things actually, but he said something very intelligent about presidents. He said, if the Nuremberg principles were applied, every post-World War II president would have to be hanged. He's right, and that includes Barack Obama. He's a war criminal just like every other Democrat and Republican before him, all the way up to World War II. So, you know, it's going to be the same thing next time, whoever it is, unless the American people wake up. And why do you have an electoral college system, by the way? Jesus Christ. Isn't this 2010? Why is there an electoral college system?
Because we have to.
I don't know how much more difficult it needs to get, but the American people would be wise to wake up.
Because we have to yield to the brilliant people of Iowa and South Dakota to rule our nation. Ken, thank you for being outspoken. Thank you for being on the front lines. You do have a great deal of support in the United States. It's certainly not reflected in the media or in the political system, but there are a lot of people here who understand the basic human rights and aspirations of the Palestinian people and the extent to which those are being brutally suppressed and denied. So thank you for joining us today. I hope to talk again in the future, and I wish you safety in your work.
Let me just say to you, my brother, that the truth teller is the most important person of our times, and that's what you're doing right now. So respect and love to you, and all the best to all the good Americans who are doing their best to turn the country around. I hope you succeed, and I'll be happy to return to my birth nation if indeed it can act with honor once again.
Ken O'Keefe in Gaza City today. Thanks for joining us on the Peter B. Collins Show. As always, my thanks for listening to this episode of the Peter B. Collins Show. I welcome your emails, peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until